Prologue. Two turns of the screw. It was Christmas Eve, and there we were, listening to the story, sitting around the fire, holding our breath, and, except for one or two comments about the scariness of the tale, generally very quiet. Everything was as it should be. The story was strange, the house was old. Someone said that this was the only story he remembered where a child had been involved. It was the tale of an apparition, which had taken place in a house very like the one where we were staying. A small child, asleep in his room, had been woken up by the appearance of this terrible apparition. The child's terrified screams had woken the mother, and as she went to calm her child, she had seen the exact same thing. The observation that it was unusual for such stories to involve children seemed to interest Douglas, and I thought he might have a story he wanted to share, so I waited. Just before we all went to bed, he explained what was on his mind. "I quite agree that Griffin's story of the ghost, or whatever the apparition was much more interesting because it first appeared to the little boy. I know of another similar story involving a child. If the child gives the effect another turn of the screw, what do you think about a story involving two children?"
"We say, of course," somebody exclaimed, "that they give two turns of the screw, and that we want to hear about them."
I can see Douglas standing in front of the fire, looking at us with his hands in his pockets. "Nobody except me, until this moment, has ever heard this story. It is absolutely horrible." Several people, naturally, thought this made the prospect even more exciting, and our friend, with great skill, looked at each of us in turn and said, "It's worse than anything. Nothing at all touches it." "For terror?" I remember asking.
"For dreadful... dreadfulness." "Oh, how delicious!" cried one of the women.
He took no notice of her. "For general ugliness and horror and pain."
"Well then," I said, "just sit right down and begin."
He turned to look at the fire and watched it for a moment. Then he turned to us again.
"I can't begin. I shall have to send to town for it."
Everyone groaned in disappointment, so he explained. "The story's written. It's in a locked drawer. I could send the key to my servant and ask him to send the envelope to me here." It seemed as if he wanted us to encourage him, to stop him from hesitating. He had broken the ice, ice which had formed over many winters. The others were irritated that they couldn't hear the story immediately, but I asked him to write first thing the next morning, so that we could hear it as soon as possible. Then I asked whether the story had happened to him.
"Oh, thank God, no," he answered quickly.
"And were you the person who wrote the story down?"
"No, I have the impression here." He put his hand on his heart. "I've never lost it."
"Then your manuscript is in old faded ink and in the most beautiful handwriting." He paused.
"A woman's. She has been dead for 20 years. She sent me the story before she died."
They were all listening now, and some people, of course, were wondering about Douglas and the woman. He wasn't annoyed.
"She was a charming person, 10 years older than I."
"My sister's governess," he quietly said. "She was the nicest governess I have ever known. It was a long time ago, and this story happened many years before that. I was at university,
and when I came home the second summer, she was already looking after my sister. It was a beautiful summer, and we often went for walks in the garden. We talked a lot, and I thought she was extremely clever and nice. Oh, yes, don't smile like that. I liked her very much, and she liked me too. If she hadn't liked me, she wouldn't have told me the story. She had never told anyone.
Because it was so frightening? He continued to stare at me. You'll easily see why. You will. I stared back at him. I see. She was in love.
He laughed for the first time. You are perceptive. Yes, she was in love. I mean, she had been in love. That was clear. I remember the time and the place. The beautiful garden, the shade of the trees, and the long, hot summer afternoon. It wasn't the place for a horror story, but, oh.
He walked away from the fire and sat down in his chair. You'll receive the envelope Thursday morning, then, I said. Probably not until the second post. Well then, after dinner, you'll all meet me here.
He looked at us all again.
Isn't anybody going?
He seemed to hope.
Everybody will stay.
I will, and I will,
cried the ladies, although earlier they had been planning to leave. Mrs. Griffin wanted more details.
Who was she in love with?
The story will tell, I replied.
Oh, I can't wait for the story.
The story won't tell, said Douglas. Not in any obvious way.
That's a pity. That's the only way I ever understand.
Won't you tell, Douglas?
Somebody else asked.
He jumped up.
Yes, tomorrow. Now I must go to bed. Good night.
And quickly picking up a candle, he left us.
Mrs. Griffin spoke.
Well, if I don't know who she was in love with, I know who he was in love with.
She was 10 years older, said her husband.
All the more reason at that age.
And now he finally wants to tell the story.
This, I replied, will make Thursday night interesting.
Everyone agreed with me, and we could think of nothing else. So we all said good night and took our candles up to bed. The next day, we discovered that a letter had been sent to his London apartment by the first post. We said nothing to him till after dinner, till the time of the evening that was best for stories containing an element of fear. Then he began to talk, just as we had hoped. He thought it was important to explain some things on this second night before the envelope arrived. To cut a long story short, I should say that the manuscript arrived on the third day, and that Douglas finally started reading it to the party on the fourth night. By then, some of the ladies had left the party. Their departure made our group more compact and select, and this only added to the atmosphere. Douglas gave us this information in the form of a prologue. His old friend, the woman who wrote the story, was the youngest daughter of a country clergyman. Her father was poor, so at the age of 20, she answered an advertisement to work as a governess. She was invited to London to meet her possible future employer. She arrived at Harley Street, a fashionable London address, and met the gentleman. He was impressive, unmarried, and in the prime of life. A fine gentleman of the type she had only met before in her dreams or in old novels. This anxious, shy girl from a country vicarage saw a handsome, bold, pleasant man who was relaxed, cheerful, and kind. She was impressed with his wealth, his good looks, and his charm with women. His London residence was fine, full of souvenirs from his travels, but he wanted her to go to his family's country home. The gentleman explained the situation. He was guardian to his nephew and niece because their parents were dead. The children were a worry for him because they were young and because he was single with no children of his own. He was, of course, determined to do his best for the poor children, although he had made some mistakes in the past. The children lived at Bly, the house in the country, and he visited them from time to time, but it was very unfortunate that they had almost no other relatives, and he was a very busy man. A servant, called Mrs. Gross, was in charge of the house for the moment, and she was a very good woman. There were plenty of other servants to help, but the new governess would be in charge. In the holidays, the governess would also have to look after the young boy. He was away at school during term time, despite being very young, but there really was no other choice. The children had had a governess before, but they had, unfortunately, lost her. It was a shame. She had been a respectable person, and she had been the perfect governess until she died. Since then, little Miles had gone to school, and Mrs. Gross had looked after little Flora. There were also a cook, a couple of maids, an old pony, an old groom, and an old gardener, who were all very respectable indeed. Douglas had told his story up to this point when someone asked a question.
"And what did the former governess die of?"
Our friend answered quickly.
"That will become clear. I'm not going to tell you anything in advance."
"But you are telling us things in advance."
"If I were the new governess, I would want to know
if there was any danger."
Douglas finished my sentence.
"She did want to know, and she did find out. You'll hear tomorrow what she found out." Meanwhile, of course, she was a little concerned at the responsibility. She was young, inexperienced, and nervous. The position of governess seemed serious and quite lonely. She went home for a few days to consider the offer. The salary was very good, and she soon returned to London to accept the position.
Douglas paused, and I decided to comment.
"The splendid young man! He charmed her!"
He got up and went to the fire, and, as he had done the night before, watched it for a moment.
"She only saw him twice?"
"Yes, but that's the beauty of her passion." I was surprised when Douglas turned to me.
"It was the beauty of it." "There had been other applicants for the position," he continued, "but they hadn't been charmed. The gentleman explained honestly that some had thought the position sounded boring or strange, or that they hadn't liked his main condition, which was that she should never bother him, but never, never. She should never write to ask him anything or to complain about anything. She had to solve all problems herself, be in total charge of everything and leave him in peace. She promised to do this, and he was delighted. When he took her hand and thanked her for the sacrifice she was making, she felt rewarded."
"But was this her only reward?" one of the ladies asked.
"She never saw him again."
"Oh!"
said the lady. Douglas left, and there was no more discussion of the story until the following evening, when, sitting by the fire in his best chair, he opened the faded red cover of a thin, old-fashioned, gilt-edged album. The whole thing took more than one night, but on the first night, the same lady asked another question.
"What's the title of the story?"
"There isn't one."
I have one, I said. But Douglas took no notice and began to read in a fine, clear voice, which echoed the beauty of his author's hand.